The Secretary shares the concern of the international community about the security situation in Afghanistan, which is clearly not going in the right direction.
The U.S. government expresses concern for Afghanistan. It's Thursday, the 12th of August, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, we explore who might be helping the Taliban. A harder line from North to South Korea. A hidden tragedy in a place of beauty. Health experts urge President Biden to do more to increase the global supply of coronavirus vaccine. Hundreds of New Yorkers band together to find a lost dog. It is all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. officials are now acknowledging that the security situation in Afghanistan is rapidly deteriorating. They say they're working around the clock trying to stop the Taliban violence. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
As the violence in Afghanistan reaches new levels, especially against children, U.S. officials are admitting that the security situation is grim. As U.S. forces prepare to withdraw from the country by the end of this month. John Kirby is the Pentagon spokesman.
The secretary shares the concern of the international community about the security situation in Afghanistan, which is clearly not going in the right direction. The secretary continues to believe that the Afghan forces have the capability, they have the capacity to make a big difference on the battlefield.
Pressed about the fate of the Afghan people after U.S. forces depart, Kirby said the stakes are high.
But this is their country. These are their military forces. These are their provincial capitals, their people to defend. And it's really going to come down to the leadership that they're willing to exude here at this particular moment.
Asked if President Joe Biden is disappointed that Afghan national security forces have not been better able to push back the Taliban, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said this.
I don't think we have the luxury of just feeling disappointed. Our view and the president's view is that now is the time for them to utilize the training, the assistance, the security guidance that they have been provided over the last two decades.
One expert told VOA that Biden still has a big decision to make. Michael O'Hanlon is with the Brookings Institution.
Well, the United States now has a big decision to make as to just how hard it's going to try to prevent Taliban takeover of the country. And I think that U.S. air power is the number one swing variable. It's the number one thing we have not yet fully decided that could make a big impact.
At Tuesday's State Department briefing, spokesperson Ned Price also admitted the security situation was deteriorating rapidly, but said Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad and his team are back in Doha, Qatar, for talks with the Taliban, working around the clock to find a way out of the crisis. Ned Price is the State Department spokesperson.
He will press the Taliban to stop their military offensive and to negotiate a political settlement.
Some experts agreed but warned against high hopes. Scott Warden is with the U.S. Institute of Peace.
So I would not expect a big breakthrough at this, but I think it is an opportunity to put increased pressure onto the Taliban and also to adjust expectations.
The decision on any potential last-ditch efforts by America to prevent a Taliban takeover of Afghanistan rests squarely on the shoulders of the U.S. Commander-in-Chief, President Biden. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
As that was happening, the Taliban was continuing to sweep up more and more sections of Afghanistan. Next, we take you to Kabul for the latest. Stay with us. These are some of the stories you'll find at voanews.com. The largest Hong Kong teachers union disbands amid a crackdown. Chinese-Russian militaries hold drills in northwest China. U.S. provides $50 million in humanitarian aid to Myanmar. Six EU countries want to maintain deportations of Afghan asylum seekers. The Indonesian army has ended a controversial practice of virginity tests on women who apply to become cadets. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. Taliban fighters took control of another city in northern Afghanistan Wednesday, an official said. The eighth provincial capital to fall to the insurgents in 6 days as U.S.-led foreign forces complete their withdrawal. Joining us on VOA Asia from Kabul is Aisha Tanzim, VOA's bureau chief in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Aisha, how much territory has the Taliban taken in Afghanistan?
The latest that we have is that the Taliban have taken over 9 provincial capitals. They started on Friday, and as we have been reporting, and by yesterday, they took over the 9th capital. And after that, now they're in full control of the entire northeast and a large part of the north of the country. So the situation is becoming dire. There are only 1 or 2 provincial capitals left in the north. One of them that the Taliban have attacked or tried to take over multiple times is Mazar-e-Sharif. On Sunday, Mazar was in panic because the Taliban said they were attacking, but they couldn't manage it. They were stopped 20 kilometers from the city. So today, President Ghani is in Mazar-e-Sharif along with warlord and the highest ranking military official in Afghanistan, Marshal Abdur-Rashid Dostum. What he's trying to do is to stop this momentum of Taliban by drumming up support among old warlords who can mobilize people into what they're calling locally as public uprising forces. We need to remember that in Herat, it was one old warlord, Ismail Khan, who managed to stop the onslaught of Taliban. Yes, he was helped by ANDSF, but he's the one who took the lead. So if these public uprising forces organize, and if the old warlords manage to mobilize them, it could be definitely a boost for the Afghan defense and security forces.
There have been some reports that some high-ranking military officials, at least one, has been replaced already, and some news that was apparently leaked that said it might be within the next 6 to 9 months that the Taliban could take Kabul. What do you hear about these bits of information?
Yes, I have reached out to some sources to find out what they think about this this story. I think Reuters filed it, which said that the Taliban can take over Kabul in a couple of months. I think the general perception around here is that, yes, that is one of the scenarios, but that is the worst case scenario, which is if everything goes south, if everything falls apart. It is not a foregone conclusion, and there is a possibility that the Afghan army can get its act together, that the warlords realize it's an urgent situation, President Ghani realizes it's an urgent situation, and they put aside their political differences, which have been around for years, and in this region, political differences among warlords and the central government have been the norm for like centuries. So they put aside their political differences, come together, and they can hold their ground. So yes, that is a scenario, but the worst case scenario. As for the changing the leadership, yes, President Ghani has changed the army chief. He's taken someone who was catching flak for not delivering, and he took the head of the special forces, and special forces has been the most successful part of the Afghan defense forces against the Taliban, and he took the head of special forces and now put him in charge of the army.
Is anybody helping the Taliban? There are reports that Al-Qaeda is contributing and maybe some other countries.
We know from UN reports that Taliban have not broken ties to Al-Qaeda. It'll be very difficult for Taliban to break ties with Al-Qaeda because their relationship goes back 4 decades, and it's not just a military relationship. Over the 4 decades, these people have intermarried. They are now linked with ties of, relationships and blood and also friendships, you know, fighting in the trenches together. So on the ground, is Al-Qaeda helping Taliban? There's a very high likelihood that its fighters are. Is it helping strategizing? Afghan government is also leveling allegations against neighboring Pakistan and saying that a lot of new jihadists are coming in over the borders from Pakistan. We also know that some dead bodies were received in Pakistan and were buried there of fighters from Afghanistan. What is unclear so far is whether these new jihadists that are coming over, whether they have the support of the government or whether the government even knows about them crossing the border, because Afghanistan-Pakistan border has been porous for a very long time, and these jihadist links go back decades. The Taliban, a lot of them are former students of madrasas in Pakistan. In the 1980s, when the jihad started against the Soviet Union at the time, a lot of these people were trained in Pakistan, were given education in madrasas in Pakistan at that time with support of the United States and some other countries. So what the ties that developed there were never broken, and they continue to this day. So we know of reports of fundraising in other parts of the region, Pakistan included. There are some reports of Iran helping the Taliban, or at least allegations by some in the Afghan government and, like, you know, casual chats. This region is very complicated. There are a lot of formal channels of support, and there are lots of informal channels of support. Like, money comes here from Middle East because Taliban subscribe to a very strict brand of Islam, similar to Saudi Arabia, for example. So the resources are coming from all over, and it's very hard to identify for each offensive where exactly the help came from. I mean, that's part of the problem in this region.
Aisha Tanzim is the VOA bureau chief for Afghanistan and Pakistan. She's been a very, very busy person over the past few months, and we thank you so much for being with us, Aisha.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, five people jumped from an apartment building in Myanmar's main city of Yangon, killing at least two of them in a bid to escape a raid by security forces, sparking condemnation among opponents of military rule. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. North Korea on Wednesday said South Korea and the United States missed a chance to improve relations and are risking a serious security crisis by choosing to escalate tensions as they conduct joint military drills. Flora Bradley Watson reports.
North Korea has accused the U.S. and South Korea of risking a serious security crisis by conducting joint military drills. In a statement carried by state media on Wednesday, senior official Kim Yong-chol said Washington and Seoul were responding to Pyongyang's goodwill with hostile acts. He singled out Seoul for what he said was a missed opportunity to improve inter-Korean relations by going ahead with the exercises. In the statement, he said the South must be made to, quote, clearly understand how dearly they have to pay for choosing their alliance with Washington over peace between the Koreas. Kim previously played a leading role during historic summits between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump. His comments come a day after the powerful sister of North Korea's leader warned about the military drills. For a second day in a row, North Korea also did not answer routine calls on inter-Korean hotlines. The phone lines were only reconnected at the end of July, more than a year after the North severed them amid rising tensions. The South and the U.S. began preliminary training on Tuesday and start wider-scale computer simulations next week.
Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson reporting.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Thai police fired water cannon, rubber bullets, and tear gas at protesters in Bangkok for a second day Wednesday as demonstrators rallied against the government and its handling of the coronavirus crisis. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Vast tea plantations spread out over Malaysia's rugged highlands, where a network of greenhouses harvest fruit, vegetables, and flowers and crops nestle in the hills. At first glance, the scenes present a picture of idyllic rural life in the Cameron Highlands, a hill station in the tropical Southeast Asian nation established during British colonial rule. But the region's farmers are fighting for survival due to a worsening coronavirus outbreak that has decimated the virtual tourism industry and caused labor shortages. Chai Kuk Lim, Cameron Highlands Vegetable Farmers Organization's president.
In Cameron Highlands, if strawberries, if there are no tourists coming here, if this pandemic goes on for another year, people won't grow strawberries anymore.
Malaysia's outbreak is driven by the Delta variant. To date, authorities have reported more than 1.1 million cases and more than 9,000 deaths. The government imposed a new nationwide lockdown at the start of June, dealing a fresh blow to the already struggling economy. Chai of the Farmers Organization said that Malaysian consumers will ultimately be the ones impacted by the crisis. China has opened the doors of what it bills as the world's largest planetarium, a slick new Shanghai facility showcasing that nation's recent extraterrestrial exploits while notably downplaying those of space pioneers like the United States. Beijing has spent much of this year bombarding the public with news of the country's rising space prowess, part of a larger propaganda blitz highlighting Chinese achievements under the ruling communist to mark the party's 100th anniversary. In recent months, China has landed a spacecraft on Mars, set loose a rover to explore it, and sent the first astronauts to a Chinese space station. Scale model replicas of spaceships from these and other missions figure prominently at the new Shanghai Planetarium, along with paeans to China's rapid scientific advancement and clips of President Xi Jinping addressing the nation's techonauts. A visitor named Zhao had this to say about the new planetarium.
This year we had several astronauts go to space, which I think is a source of pride for China. So I wanted my child to have some knowledge about space from a young age.
The building was designed by New York's Aniada Architects and resembles a union of swirling galaxies. It covers 38,000 square meters or 420,000 square feet of floor space, which is roughly equal to 5 football fields. And it costs 600 million yuan. That is 93 million U.S. dollars, according to Chinese media. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman. Making headlines in Asia, a large landslide struck a bus and several other vehicles traveling on a highway in the mountains of northern India Wednesday, killing at least 10 people and trapping dozens of others. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. This is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. The Washington Post reports that more than 175 public health experts, scientists, and activists have sent a letter to U.S. President Joe Biden urging him to do more to increase the global supply of coronavirus vaccines to stop the emergence of more contagious variants. The signatories called on President Biden to announce an ambitious global vaccine manufacturing program within the next 30 days, saying such a plan is the only way to control this pandemic, protect the precious gains made to date, and build vaccine infrastructure for the future. More police are being sent to Sydney's COVID-19 hotspots as Delta variant cases continue to surge in Australia's biggest city. State health authorities in New South Wales have said a lack of compliance with lockdown rules in districts with large migrant populations has been fueling the outbreak. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
With Australia's two biggest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, in lockdown, Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the situation is dire.
We are in a tough, tough fight with this Delta strain.
A senior state government minister in New South Wales, Australia's most populous state, has said a lack of compliance in some migrant-heavy neighbourhoods has made the outbreak worse. About three quarters of New South Wales state's nearly 5,000 active cases come from 9 Sydney local government districts in the city's west, where many migrants live. On Wednesday, officials reported 344 new COVID-19 cases and 2 more deaths, including a man in his 30s. Brad Hazzard, the New South Wales Health Minister, says some areas of Sydney with large immigrant populations continue to ignore the regulations.
There are other communities, other people from other backgrounds, who don't seem to think that it's necessary to comply with the law and who don't really give great consideration to what they do in terms of its impact on the rest of the community.
However, community leaders, including local politicians in migrant areas and asylum seeker organisations, believe that proper lockdown guidelines have been lacking for many non-English speaking migrants. Only 23% of Australians are fully inoculated. Authorities say that figure needs to be 80% before life can start to return to normal, but that might not happen until mid-November. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We continue on VOA Asia. Heather Angus, a frontline nurse who cared for COVID-19 patients in New York City, lost her dog and turned to social media for help recently. Hundreds of New Yorkers came together, and it wasn't long before the puppy was safely back home. Anna Nelson has the story. It's narrated by Anna Rice.
An idyllic picture of a happy dog and its owner. But behind this scene is a tale about how New Yorkers united to help Heather Angus, an emergency room nurse, find her lost dog. The trouble started when Angus got a call from her housekeeper as she was finishing her shift at the hospital.
Indy is gone. Indy ran away. And I just sort of lost it for a second. Like, where? What do you mean? How did she get away?
Angus adopted Indy from a U.S. shelter just a few months before. Indy was rescued by animal rights activists in India, where she was found starving and in horrible condition. After Indy ran away, Angus turned to social media in a desperate attempt to find her. And New York City answered.
Sending me messages that strangers, can I get your flyer? I'm going to put it in my neighborhood. Tell me where you think she is. We can set up a search party.
Indy sightings started coming in. Angus says the dog, not used to kindness from humans, kept running away. At one point, the dog was seen in one of the longest underground tunnels in New York City. Orlando Caholo, a supervisor at the MTA Bridge and Tunnel Authority, spotted a dog on the security camera, trying to avoid a stream of fast-moving cars. He made a split-second decision to temporarily block traffic in the tunnel.
Vehicles coming into the tunnel, and not motorists not expecting to see a dog into the tunnel is the last thing you expect to see, you know, in the tunnel. So, so it would be pretty dangerous for the dog running it back and forth. There's no real place to, not a lot of room for the dog to be, like a sidewalk.
6 officers went in, but Indy managed to run off towards the highway. The officers contacted Angus to say it appeared Indy was somewhere near the city's Queens area. The rescue organization called No Dogs Left Behind helped by putting up hundreds of posters and bringing in drones to help with the search. Local newspapers published photos of the runaway dog. Indy managed to leave Manhattan before she was finally caught a week after she ran away.
The New Yorkers that just came out of nowhere to help me. It was just a very heartwarming situation.
For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, Chris Cascao, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.